now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from Classic Cults and the Cheese in Between, the movies are B. But entertainment is grade A, and I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti, joined by dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Hey, Jason. Hey, we're going back again for an anniversary film, a great fantasy film from 1949, Mighty Joe Young.
Yeah, and we'll get to it right after this.
Kind of movie you're waiting to see as John Ford and Marion C. Cooper present Mighty Joe Young, whose sensational exploits will startle you, thrill you, electrify you with hair-raising excitement and suspense. See Mighty Joe Young as he savagely resists capture in his native Africa.
Oh! Joe!
See the most fantastic relationship between beast and beauty, a mere girl mastering a primitive giant. See Mighty Joe Young, enraged by Hollywood pranksters, destroy Filmland's swankiest nightclub on a fabulous Sunset Strip.
Mighty Joe Young.
The picture that's alive with the most sensational action thrills ever filmed.
Mightier than King Kong, Mighty Joe Young.
Mighty Joe Young was released, July 27th, 1949, not to be confused with the 1998 movie produced by Disney, or the blues musician Mighty Joe Young, who, I'm just saying, you know, but I don't know the blues, I saw the other movie, but here we go. So, your director, of course, is Miriam C. Cooper and Ernest P. B. Shorchak, right? Those names should sound familiar. They are the same names you've heard before when we talked about. We didn't talk about Son of Kong. We talked about King Kong. We didn't talk about Son of Kong, though.
No.
But the same names there, too. Your screenplay is Ruth Rose. Your story concept is by credit to Miriam C. Cooper. Also, your producer is Miriam C. Cooper. And the other?
John Ford.
John Ford. Yes,
King, the king of the John Wayne Westerns. I mean, I don't think there's many John Wayne Westerns that John Ford did not direct.
Yeah. So, which is kind of crazy when you see that come up, when it says, it says producer, Miriam C. Cooper, and then John Ford, you're like, ooh, okay. Like those are names.
Yeah.
No, I understand that. I mean, but I'm saying, but those are names to have on the screen. Cause you know, that being, remember information back then was not, you know, nearly as saturated as information is now. But if you heard like a John Ford Western, like you knew that's John Wayne. That's whatever. Like it people knew what that meant. So, music was by Roy Webb. Your production company is Argos Pictures. Of course, distributed by RKO Pictures International. RKO Pictures, not international yet. They aren't international at that point. And of course, you have a 94-minute running time. Your budget was a paltry $1.8 million with a ticket return of $1.96 million. Again, all those numbers are estimated 1949 money.
That's all it was.
That's what they estimated things at.
Yeah.
Because remember, not everyone broke that stuff down, and it wasn't in the newspaper. They didn't tell you what it cost. So that's all what they can gleam off of there. But that's just on movie ticket run. That doesn't include how many times Mighty Joe Young has been syndicated or re-released. Right. It's just like King Kong. Like King Kong, what did it make? It made this much. What did it make grand total? This much, right? You know, kind of thing. Like you all can't see, I'm doing things with my hands. But you look at what it made a good amount of money. And this made good money. I mean, you know, it still made almost $2 million. It's not like it, you know.
Yeah, back then the movie theater ticket was a quarter, if anything.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, all right. So we want to talk about special. We can talk about special effects now. So your special effects here, again, this is RKO. So we're talking about, RKO, of course, where it produced King Kong, which is Willis O'Brien and stuff like that. Now, this is Ray Harryhausen,
he's called now the first technician.
Yeah.
And so he basically was the apprentice to Willis O'Brien.
Yeah.
And this is right. And the reason he even got this gig is that he had worked with George Pal doing the puppet tunes, and Willis O'Brien saw his work. And I guess Harryhausen had earlier in his career, and I mean way earlier, even when he was a young kid, actually went to see Willis O'Brien and said, I love the work. How do we do it? And so the relationship between O'Brien and Harryhausen was cemented long before he actually got to be in the movie.
Yeah. But this is many people consider this is, again, even though he's the first technician, this is
Harry's
movie. This is Harry's movie. And if nothing else, go back and look at Kong and Son of Kong. Look at the way they act, and then look at the way Joe acts, and you can see the difference in how Willis O'Brien would animate and how Harryhausen animate. Harryhausen always gave his characters a little more life, a little more, you know, personality to them. Joe Young has a lot more personality. Yeah. Not knocking Kong or Son of Kong, but when you look at them, the way Joe is much more of a character,
right?
You know, kind of thing. And I don't mean that in a negative way,
no,
kind of thing, but it's true. But good thing about it, like in Son of Kong, he's a baby gorilla also, right? Kind of thing.
And
you know,
there is a parallel between Son of Kong and Mighty Joe Young, because the facial expressions are in some scenes are similar. Whereas Kong, there is no, he is Kong.
Yep.
100% of the time.
Yeah, and that's part of what it is. When you start looking at Mighty Joe Young as a film, and that's some of the things people point back to, which is why I think Mighty Joe Young, in many people's estimation, is far more beloved than Son of Kong.
Yes,
Son of Kong always feels like
it's rushed.
Yeah, and again, the movie itself. I mean, considering how much work got done in less than a year, that's impressive. Because they did a lot of stop motion in a very quick amount of time.
Well, the thing too is, remember Son of Kong, they had done like the Triceratops. Well,
some of it was reused.
They had already done, and they had to. All they had to do was incorporate it into the movie. Son of Kong is a very short movie, compared to Kong, and the scenes of the actors did not take place, in a variety of places. They were taken on the island. They were taken in the shore.
Right.
But again, it's the thing here with Mighty Joe Young is that you had the same producers, the same directors, pretty much. Now, you might think that, boy, this is 15 years after the Son of Kong. You know, why did it take so long? Well, there was dearth of movies with gorillas, unless you're talking about, you know, the Brooklyn Gorilla or something.
Yeah, a guy
like
in a suit.
But these guys, Shedsack and Cooper, they made what was the one movie? Pompeii, where so they did pieces here and there. And then O'Brien, this was towards the end of his career, but even after this, he did the special effects stop motion in
not Journey to the Center of the Earth.
No. I'm all right.
Yeah, no, they used giant lizards in it too. Remember, he did some stop motion.
Yeah, no, but there was three. He did three of them. He did the English brontosaurus. Do you believe I can't think
English
of,
brontosaurus? What are you talking?
I'm sorry. I'm talking about the. Well, he did the black scorpion, which was 56. But he also did.
Hang on.
The giant behemoth, and then he was supposed to do the Lost World in 1960, but they wound up using the lizards.
Okay, hang on. Here we go. Right.
Yeah.
So So Willis O'Brien, his credits are so after My Adventure Young, the Animal World in 1956,
Animal World,
right. The Beast of Hollow Mountain, where he worked on the screenplay only because you can tell him Black Scorpions 1957, The Giant Behemoth, The Lost World in 1960, and then he has after he died. He's in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. But he didn't do any special effects in there. But that he's credited because he was in the movie.
Okay.
They put him in there. Yeah. He's in there. But I'm saying it. But that's it's the Animal World and the Giant Behemoth. Yeah, I couldn't think. I would never. The Giant Behemoth. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the movie, but it's nothing special.
No,
but it's
Black Scorpion.
Black Scorpion's good. We did it on here.
Well, the Black Scorpion has got the scenes where he has the animated scorpions are spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
The only detriment to that is that when the scorpion is coming into the village, it's basically
traveling mat is fine. The problem is it's a real scorpion that they use they had a real scorpion filmed. And then they kind of made it lighter, but you can see through it too much.
Yeah.
And it wasn't done with stop motion. It was done because it was done cheap.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, but yeah. All right. So let's get rolling here. In 1937 Tangakikwa territory. It's in Africa. 8-year-old Jill Young is living with her father on his ranch. Two Africans come by with an orphaned baby gorilla, and Jill trades her toys and money, and more importantly, her father's big flashlight for the baby gorilla because she wants something to play with. So this is funny because this scene plays very differently, and the same idea in the remake, the Disney remake from 98. Yeah. It plays similar idea, but this just comes across. It's just like, because again, she's dressed the way little girls dress back then, but now you're like, wow, she's not wearing a whole lot of clothes. Yeah, like she's got a little tiny little jump romper on and whatever.
She's a precocious little girl.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of attitude and stuff, which is cool. And then her dad comes home and he's like, well, he's going to get big. And you're like, it's a gorilla. How big could a gorilla get? Right. Kind of thing. And you're thinking like, well, depending on how big gorillas do get, kind of big.
Yeah. And then he says, you know, the father, there's the one line he says, you know, Jill, he's going to grow to be 700 pounds and be stronger than 10 men.
Yeah.
And that portends what happens later.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole point of it. Yeah. Not every gorilla gets to be as big as Joe is prepared is, you know, used in this movie because he is a large. Again, I know he's a 12-inch tall thing on a desk, right? But he is literally in the movie. If you look at his scale, he's a very large gorilla.
Yeah, he's about 10 feet tall.
Yeah, he's a big one. He's not because gorillas could be on the smaller side depending on whatever kind of they are. But anyway, 12 years later, Max O'Hara, who is played by Robert Armstrong, who some of you might remember from King Kong
as Carl Denham.
Yeah, actually, you know what's funny is. And his sidekick, Greg, spelled with 3 G's, one in the front, two in the back. That is, Greg is, what's his name? Greg is, isn't that Ben Johnson? Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this, okay. So Ben Johnson, who is a regular in Western. This is actually his first credited role. This is his first named credited role.
Well, he was always on the with list. Yeah.
But as a named credited actor in the movie, this is his first named credited role. And he's, again, what's he play here? A cowboy, you know, kind of thing.
Fine.
Yeah. And well, because he's got the accent and the hat.
Right, and he goes on to play quite a number of other characters, including the one with, and I tell you, the one with the. I'm sorry.
Okay. Ben Johnson went on to be in. Good grief. He was in Fort Apache.
Yeah.
Three Godfathers, Red River, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Marriage Young. Those are all right before this. Yeah, then he went on to go and be in Rio Grande, Shane, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
I don't know what you were looking for here.
No, the one with.
He's in Major Dundee.
Yeah.
He's in The Last Picture Show. I got like dozens of movies here, Dad. I'm not sure what we're looking for.
No, he's in the one I tell you the movie that
he's in Dillinger.
Dillinger, yes, and he was one of the policemen, and he's
train
also
robbers, the getaway. He's
the getaway.
The getaway. Yeah.
The getaway.
I'm saying it depending on how far you want me to go. He's also in Hang 'Em High.
No.
And the Wild Bunch.
Right. So, but now we're talking about a career that's spanning.
Oh, okay. Wait. Look, I go back to 1939. He's uncredited in all these things. His first, he was a stuntman in Three Godfathers. He's not credited until 1949, which he's actually credited.
Yeah.
And he's uncredited in some, but like he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in The Last Picture Show. Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, BAFTA Award for Best Actor in a Supporting Role, Golden Globe Award for Best Supporting Actor, Motion Picture. This is in The Last Picture. He played Sam the Lion. I've never seen The Last Picture Show. I have no idea what that is. Anyway, but yeah, but The Getaway, but then he went on, he was acting then into 1996.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
You know, where he died. So, yeah. But anyway, but yeah, so Ben Johnson is his first major as you credited role. 2 years later, O'Hara and his sidekick Greg are on a trip to Africa looking for animals to headline in O'Hara's Hollywood nightclub. Now, I'm just going to stop there for a second. These ideas that sound really good in 1949, but now sound like major violations of all kinds of animal rights laws and rules. Yes, we're going to get live lions and let's stick them in a nightclub. Now, that'll totally work. That'll be good. But you know what's funny is Robert Armstrong, obviously, he plays Denim in the other one here. He's always kind of like I haven't seen a ton of other movies, but he always kind of seems like he's the guy with a scheme or a plan. Like that seems to be the role. He's like, I got something. I can do this. Like I'm going to go to the island, get Kong. I'm going to go get it. Like it's yeah. the same character.
Well, he was in the movie right before Kong, The Most Dangerous Game. He was the drunken brother.
Right.
And again,
Faye Ray was in
Faye
that
Ray,
too.
The
Most Dangerous Game was again.
Was done right at the same time.
Same sets. Yeah. So I'm just saying, it seems like every time I see him in a movie, he's always the guy who's got a plan or a scheme. We're going to do this thing. We're going to go. The men have captured several lions and are about to leave the jungle when Joe Young appears, now 12 feet. 3.7 meters, why we need to put the meters in, I don't know, tall and weighing, they're saying here, 2,000 pounds, right? I don't know if he really would weigh 2,000 pounds, be 12 feet tall. That would be humongous. But okay, we'll just kind of go what it says here. When a caged lion bites Joe's finger, he goes on a rampage, visualizing Joe as a big micro attraction. Max and Greg try to rope him, but he throws both men from their horses and breaks free. A grown Jill Young arrives and calms Joe down. Now, we have cowboys roping a gorilla, and you're saying, you can't rope a gorilla, which is what the line of the movie says.
Yep.
And then I think to myself going, well, if I can rope a gorilla, maybe I can rope an allosaurus. I'm not saying that in Guanji you didn't rope it.
Well, you know, you,
he has less arms.
Well, you stole the only thing that I can remember. No, but there are a number of, like the opening shot of New York Harbor.
Yeah.
That harkens back to the same opening scene in Kong,
yeah.
where you hear the foghorn yep. going. And so there are, as we go through the movie, there are a number of little gets that are right, that
time together.
Yeah. It goes back to Kong. But if this is 1949, if you haven't seen Kong, none of those scenes mean anything.
Yeah.
But since we've seen it, Kong hundreds of times,
yep.
you say to yourself, I have all my notes, that happened here, that happened there. But one of the things we have to say is that the little girl, when it plays on her music box, the song Beautiful Dreamer,
yep.
that has probably the most important part in the movie,
yeah.
other than Kong, other than Joe Young.
Yeah. I was going to say that. Yeah. So, Yeah. So, I mean, that's the whole thing, is that she's able to come. She calms Joe down. And it's, again, at the time, like, this is, you know, it's kind of, people be like, well, that's crazy that this girl, like, well, if you raised him, he's just like, that's like, he's part of their family. It would make perfect sense, actually. The men meet with Jill, and Greg becomes smitten with her. Max tells her that she and Joe will be a huge Hollywood hit and be rich within weeks. And she, knowing they need the income, agrees to go to Hollywood after some sweet talking kind of thing.
But just to go back just a little bit earlier, when you first see Joe Young and he has the they have the animation of him with the cage
and the lion,
there's a little bit of levity that enters into that as the cowboys are getting on their horses and going to rope the gorilla, which you can't do. Max O'Hara he can't get on his horse. And it's obviously not Robert Armstrong.
Right, yeah.
But then he's going, and he makes these, you know, funny sounds as he's trying to get there. And he says, you know, wait for me. Mm-hmm. And then Joe picks him up by the collar and swings him back and forth. And it's just a little bit of levity at this point, where you had zero levity in Kong.
Well, yeah, a very different kind of movie, though, too. King Kong is not made... I mean, I know nowadays there's nothing in it that would be too terrifying for most children, but I feel like Mighty Joe Young was made not to say for a younger audience, but to appeal to a bigger audience.
Right.
Yeah, and where Kong was very much a serious movie. We're making this. I mean, and in 1933, I mean, how many kids were really going to like movies often? You know what I'm saying? Like to go out to the movies was a big deal. Like you went to
It was the height of the Depression.
Yeah. So I'm saying, like, I mean, yeah, right. So you know, it wasn't
do you have a nickel to go to the movie?
Yeah.
No, a nickel to buy bread.
Yeah. That's right. That's all the money you had for the week.
Yeah.
You weren't wasting.
In that scene, there is one really nice effect. Obviously we're using a lot of blue screen here with Joe Young.
Traveling Matt.
But there's one scene where the horses run in front of Joe and behind him, which is hard to do.
Yep. Well, so that's achieved with two different screens.
Yes.
And the mats traveling between. Yeah, it's not easy. None of the effects in this movie, which still hold up really well, you know, 75 years later, nothing seems too dated, too out there. There are a couple of scenes that have always been kind of like, oh, I saw the banana go too far or whatever kind of thing. Like, but those are little things that if you're trying to nitpick, it's fine. But the effects still hold up to this day, you know, 75 years later. Right, so they agree to go to Hollywood. Okay. On opening night, Joe lifts the platform of his head, holding Joe playing Beautiful Dreamer on a grand piano. Okay. So that scene when he's got her, that is one of the most iconic scenes in this movie. And it's turning and he's holding the piano. He's holding the thing with her on the piano. She's playing the piano. And he just lifts her up and he's rotating around so it can see, right? The lead into that scene is very much this stuff from Kong. When they're like, well, we're going to, I don't, can't sit this close.
Right.
He makes pictures about monkeys. What's this guy doing? Like, it's all that, like, I don't want to, how to say it, like jibber jabber that's happening. It's just there to fill time.
Right.
But it makes it real.
Yeah. And like even it says Max O'Hara's Golden Safari, Mr. Joseph Young of Africa. That harkens back to Kong sign, the eighth wonder of the world. It's almost exactly the same plate on there. They just changed the words around.
Yep. But I think they were doing that on purpose. They want you to 33 is not that removed from far from 49.
No, it's still 15 years, and it hadn't been a movie like this.
But Kong came out again, and it was re-released.
It was re-released in 39.
Right.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, Kong was re-released in 39. I didn't say
In 47. It was done in it was re-released in 40. It might have been 39 and 47.
And 47. But Kong was re-released more than once.
Yeah.
But I'm saying is, but King Kong still had enough name recognition to people, and you know, so when it was re-released, it did well in both those. Kong has never done poorly in a re-release.
Yeah.
It always does well.
Yeah. But the other thing, there's another thing here is the opening before they show Kong, lifting Terry Moore up. There's a dance number and the music sounds very similar to what you know, to the let's get this on film, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so you wonder why they did that, because it's if you want to make a movie that stands alone,
but
yet you keep referring back.
But do you want to make a movie that stands alone, or you want to refer back to a movie that people absolutely love, one of the biggest movies of all time?
Right. Yeah. Well, again, that's the consideration.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So yeah. do you still make it unique? Joe Young is still, you know, Joe himself is different than Kong. Like what happens in the movie is different.
Yep.
But do you want? I mean, the trailer literally says, "Not since King Kong has something been this," and it says King Kong across the whole screen.
Right. Hey, let me now one last thing before we do this.
Yeah.
As a good observer, when the crowd is they're at the tables and they're sitting at the bar and they're wondering what the heck is going on, there's one scene of a pan down the bar, bar stools. One of the patrons that's sitting there that obviously has got a career later on, Richard Denning.
Oh my God, is it?
Yes. Oh. It goes by quick, but I said, holy good, that's Richard Denning.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who's the creature from Black Lagoon and a whole bunch of other movies.
Yeah. Oh.
Lisa said, what that he's a pretty face.
Yes. 49. He's real young, great in getting into acting.
Yeah.
Where are we here? So opening night, okay. On the grand piano. Following that, Joe has a tug of war with the 10 strongest men in the world, quote unquote, which he easily wins. Okay, so the French Angel is in there. There's a whole lot of professional wrestlers, including the former boxing champion, Primo Carnero. And Primo Carnero was a name people knew. And of course, the last two left are the French Angel and Primo Carnero. Now, if you've never seen the French Angel, he had a face for radio. And I don't mean to be that mean, but he was a professional wrestler. He was a heel. The French Angel was a bad guy. He was not a good guy. But back in the day, you know, everything was done so using ethnicity was a very big thing in wrestling. It didn't go away. It stayed on for a long time. Nowadays, everything's kind of like, they still do it, but it's not as much. But like, this is even before the Bruno Sammartino, you know, kind of like, you know, really going to the Italian Americans and, you know, in the Northeast and that's how you do it. But the French Angel was, you know, people were like, oh, his face is so hideous and this. He's not exactly got leading man looks, but like he's a big dude.
Oh no,
you know, none of these guys were small, and they all do like, rip the phone book in half. Right. Or Primo Canaris is the best. I love Primo Canaris. He has the steel bands and he flexes his muscle and shoots them off, which you actually can't. Now, I don't care if they're not steel bands; you couldn't do that with anything. Do you know how hard it is to get the muscle that big that quickly without actually ripping your skin apart? But it's movies, you know.
And also one of the other wrestlers, Man Mountain Dean.
Yeah.
And again, they were real at the time. Yeah. And you know, in the 50s, not so much Primo Carnera. They made a movie, it's the one with Jackie Gleason as the manager. And it's supposed to harken back
It's not Requiem for
Henry. Yes, that's a Requiem for Henry. And that's supposed to, they based it on Primo Carnera, who they was supposed to become a wrestler.
And he did.
And so that's what it was
based on. Well, after the box, he had a name. Primo Carnera's name was bigger than anything he could ever do. And he was a boxer and he was a former head champion. And
Max Baer knocked the living daylights out of him.
He was the Italian heavyweight champion. Yeah. And, Max Baer was the world heavyweight champion. So, but there's a reason why guys like Joe Louis and guys like that, like those boxers never wanted to wrestle because they could actually box. And the guys who were pretty good could make more money wrestling, you know, and not get their block knocked off every day, you know, kind of thing in a ring. So, but that tug of war is famous where he's just yanking him into the water. And, you know, but it's always funny though, when you look back at that, that's something that a lot of people remember. Even if they've never seen the movie, they just know, like, oh, isn't there a scene in King Kong at the time? Like, no, this is why you're young, you know, because people conflate things together. Like, oh, didn't this happen? Like, no. Like, why would you have a 50-foot tall, you know, ape? That would be insane. These guys would be, you know, little tiny, you know, miniature people to him. A 12-foot tall gorilla, okay, you can buy that. It's crazy, right? But they redid the same scene, kind of similar scenes in the remake and stuff like that. And it's all about, you know, putting it out there again, but it gave people also faces they knew from television because wrestling was on the Dumont Network and stuff like that. So those are names they would name. And everyone's looking at those guys going, well, they must be wrestlers. Look at them. right?
There's only one. About the fourth or fifth one in, I don't know what his name was, but he was in a lot of Abbott and Costello movies.
Yeah.
And again, could he have just been
a strong guy or a big guy? Yeah, of course. But they had to make a living doing something.
Yeah,
you know,
they weren't Schwarzenegger types.
Well, no, but
they were just.
But that's what wrestlers look. Wrestlers back in the day didn't look like this.
They were just brutes.
Think about Bruno Sammartino, who was going to be one of the biggest men of his day. He didn't have an ab or whatever. No. Like, but Bruno, no one was doubting whether or not he could rip
a tree out of the
right
ground.
Him or like Danny Hodge. No, those of you who don't know who Danny Hodge is, he was the it's Oklahoma, like two-time NCAA state champion, was like the Olympics. His hands were so he could rip like they were ripping phone books. He would tear things in half. His hands were so strong he could lift guys, and he was so strong what he could do. He got in a car accident. He ripped the door off the car, bent the steering wheel back, and got himself out. You're like, how did he do that? Because that's how strong they were. But at no point were like, wow, that guy's like shredded up. He didn't look like a bodybuilder. They looked like athletes.
Yeah.
And that's what guys were. You know, that's why the superstar Billy Grahams were so out there. Superstar Billy Graham was the first one to look like an Adonis. I mean, he was just like,
yeah.
And you look at Billy Graham, you're like, oh, he's in good shape, but he's not in fill in the blank now. He's not, you know, The Rock or John Cena or whatever, right? But like those guys didn't exist back then. That, you know, so, but these guys, every one of them, you're looking at those guys there, you're not thinking like, that guy's small. Nope. Everyone's big. And they get bigger as they go. Yeah. I mean, Canero obviously was taller too. He was well over 6'3", 6'4". And the French Angel was no small man himself. but anyway, So Primo Canero tries to box with him, and then Joe tosses him into the audience. Now, so every guy's getting yanked in. He pulls Canero across to him. Mm-hmm. Canero punches him.
Right.
And then Joe just throws him into the audience, which is a great scene. The first, there it is, folks. ECW didn't do it first. Mayu Joe Young did it first. Wrestler through the table right there into the crowd.
Right. He actually flattens out a table.
Right. Yeah. He flattens the table. He goes in the crowd. Right?
And it's him.
Yeah.
It's him.
Yeah. He took the back bump. Well, at that point, he's not taking a huge bump. He's probably just taking a bump through a table that's got worked legs. So I'm sure it didn't feel great, but, you know, they probably were paying him. So, yeah. Right here. So Joe's popularity grows. And by the 10th week, he is Hollywood's biggest nightclub attraction. By the 17th week, he's grown tired of performing and is now homesick. Now, this is where the movie kind of takes its turn. So you're thinking to yourself going, okay, like they're kind of exploiting him. And like, it's what this all is about. This whole movie is about exploitation in the fact that Joe clearly doesn't want to do anything but live in Africa and just be happy, right? Jill didn't need to go to Hollywood. Right. But, you know, she knows they know they need money and they need whatever. So she's doing.
But O'Hara just
talks her into it.
He browbeat it to the point where you can't not want to have fame and fortune.
Right.
And
But she also knows she needs money for their reservation because, like, you know, her father's now dead.
Yeah.
You know, she's got to bring some money in. But there's other ways to do that. But it's just hard. Like in this movie, you don't. O'Hara's not he's not a, you know, twirl your mustache villain, but he's not exactly a good guy.
No.
He later becomes a good guy, but he's not exactly the good guy the whole time. But I don't think anyone there was like, oh, he's the bad guy in this. I think there are a lot of people like, well, that's the way Hollywood producers are, you know, kind of thing.
Right,
like
he just sees her
as an asset,
can bring him money.
Yeah, well, expendable asset. That's right. That's right. And I used you for everything you're worth. Joe has grown tired and wants to go home. Later, during a dinner, Greg and Jill express their feelings for one another, and Greg agrees to return to Africa with her. So they're going to try and figure out how they're going to get Joe back to Africa. Now, the idea that Greg would leave behind, like, everything to go marry her is not that far an idea. I mean, the kind of thing. No, but nowadays, that'd be a problem in a movie, Dad. So, but in 1949, that's like, oh, that's what a great story. It's exactly the story that should have been there, right? And it makes sense. And they're going to bring Joe back with them because Joe is now taken to Greg and likes him. I mean, not as much as, you know, with Jill, but he's okay, you know, kind of thing. So Joe is sitting unhappy in his cage. And then we get the drunks, the three drunks who ruin the cigarettes. They pour the drinks in there. I mean, now you're like, man, really hope they're getting their comeuppance.
And they're not just buying drinks. They've got bottles.
Yeah.
And the middle guy is Pavia. He's the captain of the ship in the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yep. So they decide to sneak downstairs and find Joe. So they sneak backstage and they find Joe in his cage. And they offer Joe an open bottle of whiskey, which he then drinks. And then he wants more. And then he drinks the next one. And then you're like, okay, so now, even if they're saying he's 2,000 pounds, even if he's 1,000 pounds, like, you start drinking that much liquor into a system that's never had anything in it, it's going to start causing issues,
right?
And of course, now Joe is getting, he wants, the guy lighting a cigar, right? Or something.
He's trying to light a cigar or cigarette or something.
Yeah. And he burns Joe with it. He burns Joe with the lighter or the match, right? He burns his finger, the cigarette lighter, you're right, the cigarette lighter. Which then, of course, causes him to be in pain, and he rages. Now he's drunk and rages and destroys the cage and now breaks out. And now this is the other famous scene, is him tearing apart the nightclub.
Yeah.
Right? Because why? We now have lions behind that thick glass, but now you have lions on Joe in a nightclub. Like, the poster shows lions in the nightclub and whatever kind of thing, right? But then that nightclub, you think, oh, it's in Africa. So this is in a nightclub. He's fighting lions in a nightclub in Hollywood.
And there's a couple of scenes with the patrons where the lions are real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so again, the lion tamer.
Yeah, with them.
He'd probably be the last guy on the who's running away. But the scene with the lions where Joe, and the reason that the lions are there, Joan throws a log into the glass and they freeze the lions up. Otherwise, they would have been stuck behind.
Oh, no. Yeah. Joe throws.
And there are a lot of one of the problems with this scene, in as you watch it, there are lions then start coming out of the cage. I mean, out of the.
Yeah, the glass. Yeah.
And there's the same scene 3 or 4 times
where
it's the exact same lions coming out. And then what is really good about the scene, though, is that 2 or 3 of the lions are running away. And then one of them says, "Wait, I'm going back." And he turns it's got to be a male because it's got the mane. 2 or 3 of them turn together and they run towards Joe and they jump on him.
Yeah.
This scene is just too brief.
Yeah.
You think of it as a long scene where he's fighting. I mean, he picks one up and he throws it.
Because it's the poster.
Yeah.
That's why people remember, because it's the poster too. So in your mind, you know the picture.
Yeah.
You've now extrapolated it out further. You know what's happening. Yeah.
And it's just too brief. But again, it's really exciting scene.
Yeah. So the court decrees that Joe needs to be shot. And now Greg, O'Hara, and Jill devise a plan to get him out of California using a moving van and then to a cargo ship because they're going to come down and kill him. And now this is where, I mean, again, this movie, again, it's only 94 minutes. It's 94 minutes. It's not like this is Son of Kong where it's like 70-something minutes. Like this movie, but it moves at a good clip.
Yeah.
Because things happen and there's the talking in between, but like when Joe's on the screen, stuff happens, you know?
At this point, when they're going to get him out of, try to get him out of the country, this movie takes off.
Yeah.
It just keeps ramping up and up and up. And your eyes are glued to the screen.
Yeah.
And go ahead. You keep going.
Yeah. No. So they kind of get him out of there. So they have to try to like. It's going to take precision accuracy and whatever and precision timing and accuracy to do this. And they have O'Hara fakes a heart attack. They take him up to the office where he cuts the line. They got to get the cops. Like, it's all these like series of like misdirections, right? They get him in the van, in the white van, and they say they go to get air in the tire. Now I'm just saying, I would have got air in the tire before we did this, but okay. But of course, the drunk goes to get in the back. He sees the gorilla. Yeah, right. But it messes in the police station. That's my father's language, and I'm like, I don't even know what he's saying because it's not like he speaks like
pig Latin.
Yeah, well, I don't know what it was.
No, but pig Latin. You can almost piece together.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but it wasn't like he was speaking like Italian or Portuguese or it's like jumble jamble together. Yeah. Like it doesn't make any sense. So you're like, okay, but then they're like going back and forth. You're like, what the okay. So now they're going to go chase him. So guy pulls in front of them and blocks the road, to which he throws the punch and Greg knocks him out. Go, bam, got right in the face. Now that guy, I recognize him from somewhere. I don't remember.
Yes.
He is like a character actor.
Yes.
He's got to be in a bunch of Abbott and Costello and stuff like that, right kind of thing. And he always plays a heavy. And he looks like, now I don't know if he was a boxer. I guarantee you though, anytime there's a boxer in one of those movies, he's probably that guy. Cause he looks like a face that got punched a lot. So they switch out and put him in his truck and try to get away there. But of course they turn off the road, go down the with the bridges out. Yeah. And now they're into this, like they're stuck in, I know it's not quicksand, but it's supposed to be quicksand, right? Kind of thing. They're stuck in quicksand or kind of like, or the loose sand.
Loose sand.
Right. The cops figure out what's going on. They double back now that they're, and they're trying to shoot him out the window. So now they're driving and they're trying to get it. So Joe gets out the back and helps get the van free. They get back on the road. Now the cops are shooting at them. Right. And they're like, don't, you'll hit the girl. And I'm like, I don't think these cops care. Right. Like they're at the point where like, let's just open up. If they had Tommy guns, they had to open up on this thing. It's all about just killing the gorilla.
And when the truck is coming down the road, that's a long, long scene of animation. And it doesn't end until the cops get stuck in the same sand. And then you see the cops get out. But the animation is quite a long time because it's not only Joe, it's the truck.
Yeah,
it's the background.
Yeah, everything has to be animated.
And they actually show the police car coming down the road.
Yep.
It's really a tremendous scene.
So of course now we lead to the end or the part that's infamous in this movie. I mean, and then we go to the slightly red. It's not Technicolor.
Well, it's sepia.
Say they go to sepia, which is if those of you who know your Phantom of the Opera, we know that we hit sepia. This is when the Mask of the Red Death come out, right? Kind of thing. So, but not met in this case. This case is because there's a fire and the orphanage is going up like tinder. I mean, it is burning. And you're like, we got to stop. Like, you know, and
you're supposed to get to the ship.
Right. But, and it's hard because, but how are you not going to, you're not going to save innocent children, like, you know, orphans? Like, because if you drive by the orphan fire, now you're the bad guy,
right?
Yep. So they get there, and of course that whole thing. And Greg and Jill are in there saving children and getting them out, and they get stuck up at the roof. So Joe comes up and smashes out the side of the
facade.
Yeah, but like the
attic vent.
Right?
Attic vent.
Yep. So and then he of course is going to get Jill out immediately, gets her down the tree. And she's like, no, go back, right? Kind of thing. And Greg's trying to lower down the children.
Which he does.
Wait, but then you have, so he gets in there, but then there's the one baby left in the roof. So Joe goes back up to get the child. And that's the hardest part of the movie because you're watching this and you're like, Jesus, all right, like, come on, kid. Like, you know, okay. Like, so, but Joe goes back up. And I know it's all animated and it's stop motion and whatever. But you're watching this and you know he can't die. Like, you know he can't die. But like, it's still like heart wrenching.
Yes.
You know, because he's trying to avoid the fire. He's protecting the baby. Like it's like there's nothing in this scene that's not heroic. And you're like, well, if they kill him here, he dies a heroic death. But then you're going to be furious in this movie. Right. And you don't want to have people leave mad. Right. You can piss people off the whole movie, but you got to turn them away happy. Because what's going to happen is whatever, no matter how good your movie is, that last scene tanks, the movie tanks. Your movie's okay all the way through, and the last scene hits, the movie's great. This movie's been good, solid about what's going on, and the story's been solid the whole time. But if you change the narrative here, someone's going to get mad.
Yeah, but this ending of the movie just elevates it to tremendous.
Now, this is all done. Obviously, there's stop motion, but there is actual fire being used. Like, it's small flames, it's not huge flames. And then everything's done in the projected on the back with the end. You know, it's all animated, and then when he falls, of course, what happens? He falls out of the tree, protects the child, and then the child starts going away, and then that's when he has to cover them at the end, and that's when they say, no one will ever shoot you now, because, you know, whatever. But you're like, you killed Kong at the end, and people were devastated by Kong dying. You kill the baby Kong at the end, and you're like, look, guys, we've killed two already. Neither one of those went over super well with the audience. And again, at the end of Kong, he kind of has to die. There's no reason that the baby has to die at the end, but he saves everyone's lives. Yeah. So he kind of has to. There's no reason Joe has to die. Like, there's literally no reason he has to die. So they don't kill him, obviously, but we don't know they don't kill him. You mean he's kind of there. It's implied they go back to Africa. And then when they're showing the reel at the end with the kids, and then here comes Joe. And you're like, okay, this movie is, as I said, is definitely aimed at a broader audience than Kong was. Kong was serious. Kong is, you know, there's violence in Kong. Like, I mean, like, some of the stuff was cut, but like him eating the, or stepping on people or chewing on the, right, the natives. Like, they didn't hold back. That movie was kind of, at the time, hard.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they actually cut it for release.
They had to.
You couldn't see it.
Yeah,
then,
yeah.
Then it was Janus came up and put everything back together.
Yeah. But I'm saying, because it was just too harsh.
The thing is, what you just described, you know, was a quick synopsis.
Yeah, but you got to see it, Dad.
This movie, just when you think it might be over, it's not.
Right.
And then when you think it's over at that point, it's not. It's hard to describe, but this movie has made such an effect on your mother that she will ask to watch this movie at odd times. And like when I was reviewing it yesterday,
right,
she says, "Can I sit here and watch it?" I said, "Only if you don't talk or cry or whatever, you know."
Yeah.
And that's why this movie is a classic. Yeah, it's an hour and 20 minutes or
94 minutes.
94 minutes. So it's an hour and a half. When you watch it, not that it's slow, but the story builds, But when he's drunk and he gets out, the only slow period is when they're in the court.
Yeah.
And the court says, you know, he's got to be killed because he's what he's done. That's that 20 seconds or 30 seconds is the only slow part of the last 15.
Yeah.
And the heart-wrenching thing, as Jay said, they get the Greg gets the two girls. He puts them into a blanket and lowers them down.
Yep.
And then just as he gets down to the bottom, the little girl that nobody knew about
crawls
out to the edge. And they look up and Jill says, "Go up, Joe, go up."
Yeah.
And Greg is, he's looking to throw his rope up again to go get him, throws the rope up. But now in the background of this, of these, all these scenes, the an orphanage little by little is collapsing side by side. And you can't take your eyes off the screen. And right, if you've got your mouth open, it's going to stay open.
Yeah.
And so when he throws his lasso up the flame, cuts the rope,
and now
he's stuck. And then the rest of it is just something that you just have to see.
Yeah. So Mighty Young wound up winning the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects. The only other nominee that year was the film Tulsa. The nominee was listed by the studio only, and when it came time to receive the award, it was O'Brien that went up to the stage and gave his acceptance speech of 5 words: "Thank you very, very much." That's all it was. So, which is why when Harryhausen was given his Lifetime Achievement Award, because it's a big thing.
Yeah.
Because Harryhausen was not on the stage with O'Brien getting this. And the number of people who can look back and say Willis O'Brien / Ray Harryhausen impacted the way movies are made. I mean, some people, I don't know who those people are. Like, right, but you also don't understand movies the way we're talking about movies. The impact that O'Brien had, and then that, this, the impact he had just on Ray Harryhausen, and then Harryhausen's effects, his impact on the effects industry. Both of these men, again, others as well, but the impact they had, unparalleled. No one else has had that kind of impact on films. To take where you would go from, like, the way things were animated and stop motion was, you know, again, it now people are like, "Oh, it seems like whatever." But again, then people watch a movie like the new Chicken Run that just came out, and that's all done in stop motion, and they love it. It's like, yeah, but you can't fake it. Like, it's got to be done that way, right? The impact that Willis O'Brien had, not just on American cinema, but even Japan, and I mean, King Kong was so impactful, right? And then to see what Harryhausen would do later on, take it to the next level. How many actors literally go in and then they get up there? They're like, "What's your favorite movie of all time?" Jason Yargan, 7 Voyages of Sinbad. Like Tom Hanks has said, 7 Voyages of Sinbad, favorite movie of all time. That's what you want to be. Yep, I saw that. Want to be an actor. Because he loved the Cyclops, because he loved the dragon, because he loved these effects. It wasn't, and I'm not saying anybody's from Kerwin Matthews, but like, it's not because he was like, "Oh, I want to be Sinbad." He wanted to do these things. It's insane. I want to do this.
Part of the adventure.
Right. And that's the whole thing. Like that. And again, some people might say, oh, that doesn't hold up. Go back and look. This stop motion is 75 years old, right?
Yeah.
Good God, it holds up. It's not Joe. If you want to point at something that doesn't hold up in the movie, it's the lion repeating itself. It's the little shortcuts that were taken, not in the special effects department. Everything with him looks good. Anything with, like, it still looks smooth. And this isn't, we're watching this on a seventh generation VHS tape where it's grainy. This is on DVD, Blu-ray, cleaned up as best it gets.
It's not in color. You know, the movie is not in color.
Neither
was Kong.
Yeah, so. But you look at that, like doing things in color made it harder for Harry. I admit that. But when you look at, like, even Beast of the Thousand Phasms, like, that's in black and white.
Yeah.
Right? The effects are so smooth. Ooh. Everything is so, I mean, I don't mean smooth, like digitally smooth. Everything works, looks real, has mass, does what it's supposed to do. That's what I'm saying. You watch this and you're like, the story's good. I mean, again, if the story was garbage here, this movie probably wouldn't be as well remembered. But the story is engrossing. It's okay for the whole family kind of thing. There's nothing in here like, well, kids can't see that. Like, I mean, it's heart-wrenching, and could it be upsetting at the end for kids? But he lives.
Yeah. Right. And he's a hero.
Yeah, he's the hero at the end. So it's not like he dies.
I said mom loves this movie. Yeah. You know what she says? This is a love story.
It is.
It's not a monster movie. It's a love story.
Yeah. And it's hard because Son of Kong, again, is often kind of, not to say forgotten, but kind of is not as remembered as obviously King Kong and Mighty Young. So people always put these two movies together, and then they remember, like, well, isn't there a part when this happened? They remember a piece of, like, Son of Kong, and they put it in this movie, or a piece of Son of Kong and they get the other one. So it's kind of like Son of Kong, you know, is there, but it's not really, it's kind of like the connective tissue, but it's not really there.
Yeah. The only time that was ever like, you'll call it connective tissue, is that on Christmas morning they would show
Thanksgiving.
Well, thanks. I'm Thanksgiving. Sorry. Thanksgiving.
It's Christmas morning's Babe in Toyland.
Right. That's right. Still. That's right. Yep. The Laurel and Hardy movie.
Yep.
But what they would do on Thanksgiving is that they would blend the two movies together, so that when Kong, when Denham says, no, the airplane's got him, then the movie doesn't end. They go right to the
Son of Kong.
The Son of Kong. Yeah. Where there's the Kong poster.
So WOR would show this. And what happened was WOR would advertise King Kong from noon to 3, Son of Kong from 3 to 4. It's a radio thing, and that's with commercials. So what they did was they cut the movies together. They kind of blended them. And then Mighty Joe Young would be on. And they, every single year, I mean, anybody who's friends with me online has seen me share those posters of, like, the newspaper ads.
Yeah.
I have talked about this forever. That was every single Thanksgiving. I watched those movies over and over and over again. Saw them all the time. Luke and I would watch them. Family's coming. We're getting ready. Mom's cooking, whatever, getting the table. We're kind of laying on the ground watching them. We watch them, right? The next day, they would show a Godzilla movie, and they would then probably show King Kong Escapes, which is, you know, then they would show some rando Godzilla movie with it kind of thing. But that's what WR did. But that's what I remember. And anyone who didn't grow up in New York, maybe you didn't have that experience, but anyone who grew up in the greater New York area 100% had that experience, because WOR was not cable. It was, that's Channel 9, basic TV kind of thing, basic, whatever you got over the air. So, so the whole thing is, when you look at movies, again, like Mighty Joe Young, or even we're talking about, like, obviously King Kong, you know, being his predecessor, and the movies that came later. And we said about the, you know, how they react. This movie was not well loved by critics, because they thought it was too funny and laugh and whatever. It's for kids. And obviously people went to go see it, and it was well loved to the point where it was one of those things that once it was come back for a revival or whatever, it's one of those movies people always talked about. So, but there wasn't, movies weren't readily available back then. You saw a movie and it wasn't on TV anymore. I mean, it wasn't until the Shock Theater package was sold through by Universal that even Frankenstein, Dracula, the Mummy, that's how you get to see them on TV. Remember, Frankenstein and Dracula would be re-aired would have a limited engagement Halloween night.
Yep.
You know, and people would go because you couldn't see any other way.
That's right. It was, you know, believe it or not, if you knew back then, you had a magazine which still is in existence today called TV Guide, and TV Guide would hype up what was coming, and it did all the different channels. And in New York, you didn't have many.
Yeah.
You had WCBS, WNBC, WNW, and 11.
WABC, WOR, and WPIS.
And Channel 13, which was...
PBS.
That was the educational channel.
It's still PBS. It's still PBS.
But if they were going to show Dracula or Frankenstein or King Kong, it became an event.
Oh, sure.
It became an event.
Yeah.
And again, it was WOR. It was... They were the first ones in 1957 to show King Kong on a regular basis. It would come on at 7:30 at night, and then again at 10 o'clock at night.
Yep.
And on the weekends, they showed it three times. And it was, and they did it for a whole week so that you had the opportunity to see it.
Yeah.
First time I saw Kong, my father would talk about that incessantly. He was 13 years old when he saw Kong at Radio City Music Hall. And he said, that's the greatest movie I've ever seen. When it came on the Channel 9, the million-dollar movie
yeah.
in 1957, it's playing. I must have done something a little untoward that day because we lived in the apartment below my grandmother and my grandfather. So I went upstairs and they had the movie. They were going to put the movie on, and I'm sitting there and the movie's coming on, and as Kong opens up, it talks about the Arabian proverb. My father came up, grabbed me, and brought me downstairs. And so I didn't see it until the next night.
Yeah.
Right? And then ever since then, it's been, if it's on, you can't not watch it.
Yeah. So, so it's just one of those things that, I know certain movies, obviously, for us have different meaning and different people have different experiences and stuff, but pretty much universally, My Age, Your Young is considered to be, you know, not only an all-time classic, but a lot of people have, you know, discovered it this way. And, you know, and if you've never seen it, again, it kind of could be a little difficult to get your hands on because the Blu-ray set that is available was at the time, might be out of print, but it's definitely a little harder. It's with Son of Kong, Mighty Joe Young, Them, and Beast from Beyond the Fathoms.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, that's a pretty good four-disc set. But it is available singly by itself, just as a movie. On Amazon, I'm sure you can probably purchase for like $10.
Yeah.
I didn't. I mean,
and if you can't find it there, you can find it on eBay, I'm sure.
Yeah, but again, most people, again, if they're not willing to spend money on it on Amazon, they're not looking to go spend money out there. They want to stream it, but streaming it, you can rent it from places.
Yeah.
But it's also.
Didn't you say streaming it is tough?
No. Some places have movies available all the time if you want to pay for them.
Yeah.
Prime having it like available to you at all times, Dad, like because it's a part of your Prime membership.
Yeah.
Those go on and off. But if you want to pay for something, they'll make things available. If you want to pay for things,
yeah. But I mean, so. But there are movies that we've done that are streaming either.
Because some movies they stick around forever, and some movies they take on and off. But that's why. That's the nature of streaming compared to actually owning something. Because streaming, you own nothing. But you think you own something, but all you've done is just rent it.
Another place where you'll see this come up every so often during the course of a year is TCM.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's when they do the retrospective.
And the thing with TCM is that you can always go from month to month to month online to see what movies are being shown.
Well, they do that. The thing is, they usually don't show this for Harryhausen's birthday, but they might show this when they're doing a retrospective on RKO. Or they'll do retrospective on, something will happen. Like, there'll be some retrospective on and whoever it is, and they'll have somehow tied in. Like, it might be the composer. It might be the whatever. Because they know when they put this on, if you put some movie on that this guy did and no one knows it, ain't no one watching. You put on Mighty Joe Young, you're going to get a number of people, even if they're just recording it, just willing to spend the time to be interested in what you're doing. So, all right, folks. So that about does it for our eighth anniversary episode here. We have another episode coming at the end of March. We're going back 40 years again for The Terminator. A movie that a lot of people didn't think was going to be anything, and that thing became huge. And not just because Schwarzenegger was in it, because that movie really became humongous. Anyway, but we're going to talk about that at the end of March. Got a whole bunch of anniversaries happening. Got, you know, things that are 70, 60, 50 years old. We're going to talk about some things that are a little younger than that, kind of thing as we go through. But, you know, we like to hit those anniversary years to hit them. So, all right, folks, that about does it here for us. Like we say here, keep those cars and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown, an unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots, Bugs, Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!